This is session number 50, side A, recorded on August 27th, 2007. We said at the end of session 49A that we were going to go to Bob Dobbs' charts. We had finished with Bob Marshall's charts, and we were going to begin Bob Dobbs' charts on 49B. But due to technical difficulties, we didn't do that. So the following week, we're starting afresh on a new tape, tape number 50, or session number 50, side A, and we're starting with my charts, me, Bob Dobbs, and his wonderful output. And we're going to deal with the first one at the beginning, and that's called Bob Dobbs' Formula. You want to read how the chart... Oh, we should say you go to fattycommunion.com, is it?
Yeah.
Or fivebody.com.
It's not... No, the Fatty Communion website.
Yeah, Fatty Communion website.
Right.
Is that fattycommunion.com?
Well, it's probably going to be locked down bobrule.com, but it's not linked up yet.
Okay, so anyways, you go there and you can look at the Bob Dobbs formula chart, or you can go to fivebody.com and go into chart and image archive, that section of fivebody.com, and scan down to the, what's it say, formula chart? It says Dobbs formula chart or just the formula chart.
Right.
So we'll begin with Scott reading the title of the chart.
So this is Bob Dobbs' Formula. That's the name of the chart. And
then there's a colon.
Colon. Subtitle, Co-Evolutionary Anticipatory Mimesis.
Mimesis.
Mimesis equals, this is the formula, Co-Evolutionary Anticipatory Mimesis equals How the Media Archetypes Fit the Battle of Jericho in American Politics.
So you got any questions about that?
Well, it's kind of a complex statement. It's
okay, let me say this. The formula is made up of two halves. The second half is an explanation of how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho. The Battle of Jericho is some story in the Bible where one tribe is attacking another tribe, and the second tribe is an impenetrable fortress. So the first tribe blows their trumpet and, using Gurdjieffian secret sound knowledge, melts the walls away using the Gurdjieffian octaves, right?
Uh-huh.
They don't say that in the Bible story, but it's interesting. You could look at the story as talking about, Gurdjieff's octaves. You know about that stuff, right?
Yeah, I do.
And so they were able to topple the walls and take over the protected tribe, the first tribe, and win the battle. So it says here that how the media archetypes...
I know you just drew a relationship between that and... I'm not sure exactly what the relationship is between that and the octaves of Gurdjieff, but...
But Gurdjieff talked about the octaves control humans.
They control humans?
Yeah, the moon and the angels, and it goes up his chart. He talked about how sounds... Remember he talks about how he could make certain sounds and affect people's bodies and emotions?
No, actually, I never really understood his law of octaves.
But you knew that much.
I read about it.
But you didn't know how it happened.
Right.
It would be like acoustic space manipulation in McLuhan terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'd be a hyper-intelligent knowledge about the subtleties of acoustic space that would come from cultures who were pre-literate. They'd be experts on acoustic space.
Right. So Jericho was a city?
Yeah, fortress city.
And somebody blew a horn?
Yeah, and the horn, the sound from the horn toppled the walls. They fell.
Now, you can't take that literally. So, I mean, does the Bible want you to take that literally? Somebody
I think so.
Blew a horn? And what kind of horn?
the mystery horn, the old Zappa. he has it in the Grand Wazoo album, and the liner notes of the album cover, he talks about the mystery horn.
Right.
I always thought it related to this phenomenon.
So somebody is embodied with, you know, some superpower, or they're channeling God or something, and they blow this horn.
Yeah.
And the walls come tumbling down. I remember that phrase. And the walls come tumbling down.
Yeah.
And the bad guys lose and the good guys win, I guess, according to the story. And how does that relate to American politics?
Well, and when you begin to look at the chart and study it, you see I'm talking about phases from 1750 approximately to 2020, and how different environments toppled the previous environments and created new grounds. That's the McLuhan angle on it.
Oh, yeah.
So when we have the phrase, how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho, fit can also mean, in older language terms, fighting. So how the media archetypes fight or fought the Battle of Jericho and symbolically toppled previous environments' walls, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It can also mean that how the media archetypes fight among themselves. So they fit, the first meaning is, they fit the story of the Battle of Jericho by knocking down previous environments, previous what appeared to be solid protective carapaces, shields, castles, that new environments topple them. That's going to be a part of the theme of the formula chart.
Right.
The other thing is taking the word fit, not to mean it fits the metaphor of the Battle of Jericho, but that it's a past tense for fighting. So how the media archetypes fought the Battle of Jericho, how they fought each other, not just the end result of the walls going down.
And so when you refer to the media archetypes, you're referring to telegraph, usury, manufacturers, movies, newspapers, printed book, radio, telegraph, oratory, television, movies, radio/TV, computer, atom bomb, automobile, quark tune, satellite, laser beam, television, airplane, homeopathic cliche, computer, atom bomb, television, anthropomorphic physical satellite, and laser beam, computer, and atomic bomb, homeopathic cliche, probes, and satellite, and laser beams. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah,
those are the media archetypes.
Yeah, and you said television, movies, radio, television, that should be radio/telephone, just to correct that.
Oh, yeah.
In the middle level. Yeah, so that's what I'm, that's the media archetypes.
Okay. And so the the co-evolutionary anticipatory, how'd you call it?
Mimesis.
Mimesis. Mimesis meaning to mime or to...
Yes.
Are you playing off of the word meme or the word mime?
Mime. M-I-M-E.
Yeah. So co-evolutionary. So what I just rattled off is the media archetypes are in a co-evolutionary dance with the other side of the chart, or the, is that right? The HCE or the...
No. The co-evolutionary anticipatory mimesis. In other words, the battles that are fought are prefigured by the interaction between the ground and the figures. See, it's anticipatory.
Battles
mimesis.
That are fought... The battles that are fought are prefigured by... Say that again. Prefigured by what?
The battles, as you just listed them, all the different media factors.
Well, I didn't list battles. I mean, let's just list media archetypes.
Yeah, and they're archetypal because, and we'll explain this later, by the time we had the 90s, these environments were not solid environments. They had merged into a paramedia, imploded seamless web, where there was just the digital Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
So there were no separate environments in the 90s. So these are memories of these technologies and the environments they had created when those environments were solid and not melted away in the digital simulacrum. Okay? So they are now images or icons or archetypes.
So this co-evolutionary anticipatory mimesis refer to... The end of the chart? After we've completed the chart? Is that what that's referring to?
No, it's referring to the chart how, and we haven't got into it, but we will soon, under ALP, it says
one half
state. Effects preceding causes. Effects preceding causes.
Right.
That's anticipatory almost. Something going on before, right?
Right.
And then under HZ on the far right, it says ground, it says causes, in quotes, merging with effects.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an anticipatory pre-merging of causes with effects in the column under ALP on the far left.
Right.
That's the anticipatory mimesis.
Why is it a mimesis? I don't see why it's anticipatory.
Because what's under HCE on the far right column, where the effects merge with the causes, it's like a catch-up phase. It's not catch-up the vegetable. The catching up of the ground, which is represented under ALP.
Mm-hmm.
So HCE mimes unconsciously the effects that are determining his reactions as spelled, and these effects, which are really hidden causes, are listed under ALP. So HCE is miming, and so are the children.
HCE is miming, but there's a lag.
Yes, a lag.
Instead, it's trying to catch up.
Yes. And so it's anticipatory, coevolutionary anticipatory mimesis. We understand the miming is the lag. Coevolutionary is the interaction between other media environments and the new media environments. You could say the interaction between the present and the past. All right? That's the coevolutionary to a interaction which is not limited to just one aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Not limited to the present. It's not limited to the past. It's like McLuhan used to say that media impose their assumptions on us, and we impose our assumptions on them, on the media.
Right.
So this interactiveness is what I mean by coevolutionary. And remember, the sub-effects are under the children, Shem, Sean, and Issy, the three middle columns. They're part of the miming, too.
But they're the sub-effects.
Well, they're within the dialectic between HCE and ALP. They're effects. If you get bothered by the word sub-effects, forget that. They are effects, too.
Right.
But they're children.
Okay.
They represent older environments or more innocent responses.
Yeah.
More unconscious responses. Because HCE is pretty knowledgeable, and representing the intelligence agencies, they know they've got to anticipate effects.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to be on top of it.
Right.
Okay, so you have coevolutionary, the interaction of the users and the technologies. You have the anticipatory, the actual effects caused by the ALP far left column, the efforts to bureaucratically keep up with that intuition by HCE in the column on the far right, and then the other effects represented by the children as another aspect of the mimesis that's going on.
Right.
Okay, so you got coevolutionary, anticipatory, mimesis. And that's what we're looking at over 150 years and focusing on. All of this is kind of an afterimage because they are media archetypes in the 90s. So how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho in American politics. And it's American politics understood as America as a world environment.
Right.
At least since the end of World War II, and some would say since the end of World War I.
Mm-hmm.
America takes over from Europe, and then it develops all the new technologies and spreads them around the world.
Yeah, and it doesn't have the cultural baggage of Europe, so it can take the new technologies and zoom ahead.
Yeah, it's called what was his name? Schumpeter. I think it was Schumpeter, the economist, called it creative destruction. It was the basic interpretation of capitalism. It was a process of creative destruction. New things come up and wipe out the old things. So this creative destruction process can turn over rapidly in America, which
yeah.
include Canada.
So, in a sense, America is the offspring of the Europe, and it's it's the new kid on the block.
It's the offspring, or it's an alien invader, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It is a runaway. disengages from Europe.
Yeah.
It could be a bastard child, and it's an orphan and goes off and creates its own empire.
Right. Let's see, I guess we need to point out, in case somebody happens to be listening to this and doesn't know what ALP and HCE are, ALP is Anna Olivia Plurabelle. She's one of the characters in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake.
Let me explain that.
Okay.
But so we've looked at the... So this is the formula. Something equals something else.
Right.
So the coevolutionary anticipatory mimesis equals how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho in American politics. And the process of knocking down walls has to bring in the ideas or notions that there's a hidden ground and then surface figure effects. We discussed in Bob Marshall's charts a simpler version of the hidden ground and then the figures or effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at the interplay of the ground and the figures, and understanding that will explain how the media archetypes went through the various adjustments that they did over the last 250 years.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that is summarized and equal to the statement coevolutionary anticipatory mimesis. That phrase should be understood at the end of a process of understanding what the chart means.
Yeah.
Now, the five columns below the headline, or below the formula, are five names taken from the book Finnegan's Wake, published in 1939 by James Joyce in Paris.
It was published in 39. When did he actually start working on that?
Well, on the last page of Finnegan's Wake, if you're reading the text, it comes to a phrase which ends with the words, along the, along the. And you go back to page one, and it says, river run. So some people interpret that the last sentence of Finnegan's Wake on page 628 continues on page three, which is the first page,
mm-hmm.
the number in the book, three. And all issues, all editions have the same numbering system. So you can say that the book goes into the first page again. But some people say, no, if you go to the bottom of the page, page 628, the apparent last page, it says Paris, 1922 to 1939. So Joyce is indicating the time it took to make the book. 17 years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that actually may be the end of the book. The statement, 1922 to 1939 in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how long it took him to write. And most of the time, it was serialized. Sections were printed from 1924 up to 38, and it was called Work in Progress. No one knew the title of the book until the book was released.
Serialized as released in a magazine?
Yeah, in different literary journals. Mm-hmm. One of the major ones was Transition.
Transition, that's a good title.
Yeah, and it had a small T, not a capital T.
Mm-hmm.
So, Work in Progress is what people thought the title was at first.
What's the significance of the small T?
That was the editors of Transition were celebrating the revolution of the word, or revolution in the word, that they thought Joyce's Ulysses book, which came out before Finney's Wake, they thought that book represented a revolution in writing and thinking and experimental avant-garde stuff. So it was a big avant-garde move to have the title of your magazine not have a capital letter.
Oh.
It's like E.E. Cummings writing in without capitals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have this formula at the top of the chart. Then you have these five people which form the core characters in the book, Finnegan's Wake. And it's a family. The mother is ALP, standing for, there's three letters, ALP, standing for Anna Olivia Plurabelle. Her husband is a guy named Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, and his initials are HCE. So a lot of times through the book, you'll see ALP and HCE and not the name. All right?
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it unusual back in the 20s for a couple not to share the same last name?
Probably. though in the aristocratic world, that may not apply.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, what are these two entities, Anna Livia Plurabel and Fridtjof Nierwicker? They weren't just humans. They represented archetypal forces, memes, environments, technologies, nature. ALP's a river. HCE was a mountain. Okay?
Oh, okay.
So, I mean...
Oh, yeah, ALP is... Well, ALP, ALP is a mountain, right?
Yeah, you have it right there.
Yeah.
So, the three children that they had consisted of two boys who were twins, and they were known as Shem and Sean. Shem was the sort of the bad child, and Sean was the perfect, respectable child.
Sure, they like the good and the evil.
Yeah, and Issy was their sister,
who
the two of them fought, supposedly, on the anthropomorphic level of the book, that there is actual family and these dynamics are happening. Shem and Sean fought over the affections of Issy, their sister.
Mm-hmm.
So
they fought over the effects of their sister?
No, the affections.
Oh, the affections, uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh. So those are the five names across the top, or the five, yeah, five names and initials.
How did Shem try to win her affection by sort of corrupting her in a way, and Sean tried to keep her good, or how did that happen?
Well, there were so many ideas in Finnegan's Wake. Every possible way of interpreting the relationship of the three of them is in the book.
Uh-huh.
From incest to subversive modes of Shem versus the Puritan modes of Sean, yeah. But it all switches around, and they all become interpenetrable, interchangeable, and actually you can't tell who's who eventually.
Now, doesn't Abraham have two children? One's favored and one's not, or
that was Jacob and Esau, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if he was overtones of that relationship. And
oh yeah, there's on the first page of Finnegan's Wake, it's multi-layered and references to all kinds of different cultures and histories in there. And he has Noah's sons, Ham and something, Seth, I think.
Oh.
And they see Noah drunk. So that's a scandal. And that's embedded in the first page. You'll find all the dialectics, all the interactions of sons and fathers, daughters and mothers is embedded all throughout Finnegan's Wake from all kinds of cultures.
Okay? Is that what makes it archetypal? Because it's something that's just essential nature of human relationship?
Well, if you remember when we did the McLuhan quotes in Phatic Communion, he defined archetype as a repeating pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, archetype, definitely you could say that's what Joyce was showing, repeating patterns in the human condition, regardless of cultures.
Right.
That's one level of interpreting Finnegan's Wake. You might say that's isomorphic.
Mm-hmm.
Same pattern, you can lay it over anywhere and you'll see the same pattern.
Right.
And that's called a moire pattern, M-O-I-R-E, with an acute on the E.
And it's transcultural, Western, Eastern.
Yeah. But McLuhan discovered that it was transmedia.
Mm-hmm.
Not just cultural.
Right.
It was technological communicating environments.
Right. Yeah, so you got the mom and dad and the three kids.
So let me just hold that thought. For example, on page 52 of Finnegan's Wake, you have the sentence, television kills telephony in Brothers Broil. There's the brothers, Shem and Sean.
Yeah.
And Joyce is saying that one brother is television and the other is telephone.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you going to say?
Well, it's kind of fun that you have mom and dad and three kids here, which puts a kind of a human... They all represent media archetypes and environmental... And media environments. So you're showing a kind of emerging of the idea of the human form and technology here.
Yeah, the merging of humans and technology.
Yeah, I mean, because the whole chart is all just mechanical, electrical technology, except that they're all being represented by human form at the top of the list.
The McLuhan level or the Joycean level, that technologies are extensions of humans. They are human. They are part of the human constituents.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what you're saying. There's a merger of the Western idea of a split between machines and us.
Right. Because the only reference to the human being is at the top of the columns, and so.
Well, there is in the under ISI there are lists of presidents of the United States.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So there's a slightly a human form there,
right
there.
So she tends to represent the human constituent part a little more than everybody else.
You could say that. I do have under her name anthropomorphic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But let's not go in there. Let's go back and move towards that. Because what you have under ALP, it says one half stage. Under HCE, it says other half of stage. So there's a theater being presented here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one part of the stage is hard to see. The actors don't notice it. The half of the stage that's under HCE is something that's noticeable, and that's represented by the male aspect, or the power moves that the male in a patriarchal history makes.
I wonder if it makes more sense to think of stage in terms of like stages of evolution as opposed to the stage that the actors stand on, because actors... The stage would be the ground under the actor's feet, and an actor doesn't stand on two stages, or a stage that is...
No, it doesn't mean two stages. It means two different aspects of the stage.
Of the same stage.
Yeah.
One of which is figure, and one of which is, well...
They're both there, but, yeah, they may not... One may not be visible.
Yeah, but they're both ground.
But the chart makes them visible.
Yeah.
So the, you said they're both ground. Yeah, they're two aspects of ground there. They're both more invisible than the three kids.
Yeah, and Shem, Sean, and Issy are the figures.
Right, you could say that ALP and HCE are the puppet masters, and the three kids are the puppets on the strings.
Oh, all right.
And we can see the puppet masters.
Yeah.
And there's two kinds.
Shem, Sean, and Issy can't see the puppet master,
no.
But the audience does.
Yeah. And so one type of puppet master is under ALP, and that's called bottom-up ground, and we discussed the meaning of ground and bottom-up in the Bob Marshall charts. And in brackets it says effects preceding causes. So these are effects. For example, the telegraph, if you go across the column, you see... The dates are 1750 to 1800.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the telegraph didn't show up till 1840.
Mm-hmm.
So why is telegraph listed in under 1750 to 1800? It means that humans, like Abraham Lincoln, who was discovering electricity in a modern context in 1757, I think, when he...
Who did you say? Did you say... I think you said Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, sorry, yeah, Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah.
Was discovering... with his kite that he could conduct the lightning down to a key tied to the kite, right?
Right.
So he started thinking about this natural force. And then other scientists were corresponding with him, so they started developing a language of analyzing electricity. So that thinking led to the harnessing of the electric environment through the voltaic battery, and a few other inventions around 1800. Mm-hmm. And none of the scientists who were inventing these things, trying to harness electrical energy, could foresee that it would lead to the telegraph environment, or to the telegraph.
Yeah.
Maybe they, in a science fiction sense, imagine something, but that'd be pretty rare. They were just stumbling around in this new idea caused by Ben Franklin's experiment. And so that process of stumbling around goes from 1750 until 1840, when the result of exploring electricity leads to an artifact called the telegraph.
Well, it doesn't make sense here. You say that the telegraph is the effect preceding the cause.
Yes.
But then on the cause level, you have 1750 to 1800, which precedes the telegraph.
That's right. In other words, and causes is in quote, and it's in, it says merging with effects.
Mm-hmm.
So you could call that sub effects.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that telegraph is an invisible environment, and the telegraph is the final cause that all the thinking led to. All right?
Right.
You could say it's the final cause. In Aristotle's four causes, formal causality, efficient causality, material causality, and then final causality. The final cause is what is produced.
Yeah.
So the telegraph is a final cause that is going to show up, and no one knows that's what the final cause is going to be, but wallowing around and thinking on the effects that will lead to it is the preliminary phase. So the effects of the telegraph.
1750 to 1800. So you got to explain yourself here, because now you're saying the telegraph is the final cause, but it's under the heading effects preceding causes.
Yeah. The thinking and the thinking that led to the telegraph were molded by the telegraph as a cause. That's what they were leading to.
Yeah, before the telegraph came
in. Yeah, the scientists didn't know that they were inventing the telegraph for 100 years before the telegraph showed up. They were putting the pieces together. This is what Edgar Allan Poe discovered in the early 19th century. He explained how he wrote a poem. I think the poem was The Raven.
Yeah.
A famous poem. And he said he determined the effect he wanted first, and then he figured out how to write the poem to create that effect.
Right. But so, they didn't. But that doesn't fit what you're saying here.
I know.
Between 1750 and 1800, they didn't know what they were. They didn't have the idea of the telegraph. Oh, let's work our way towards making one. Like
that's
you said,
right.
They were stumbling around, and the telegraph came into being.
That's right. Now,
but
that's
on the other hand, you're making.
That wasn't the end of my statement. That
well,
was the beginning.
Okay, I just want to raise my objection so we can be clear about what you're about to say.
Yeah, no, that's right. And McLuhan said that what was discovered in the 19th century was the technique for making discoveries. That's what was discovered. Scientists figured out how to invent something. They said, okay, we want to create this effect, and now we will work backwards and find the means to get that effect.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in the 19th century. That's 1850s and further on.
Right.
So that's like the poetic Edgar Allan Poe idea. We know what effect we want, so we're going to create a poem that creates that effect. So both art and science were coming up with the same conscious mode, right? They were becoming aware of how to create an environment. At least they thought they were. But when, 100 years before, when the effects of electricity and the experiment that Franklin harnessed showed up, the end point, which is the telegraph, and movies, radio, television, computers, and satellites, all that were going to follow from that, were not foreseen. But the way humans thought about it, they were being pulled into that effect cause. They were going to eventually invent the telegraph. It was almost predetermined.
Yeah. Isn't there a term in philosophy called teleology?
Yeah, teleology is that it's predetermined where we're going to end up.
Yeah, is that what you're saying?
Yes, that teleology would be an update of the Aristotelian idea of the final cause.
Hmm. So, and then in chaos theory, they call that the chaotic attractor.
Yes, yeah, the strange attractor.
Strange attractor.
Yeah. One of McLuhan's students, Frank Zingroni, he did a whole book of poetry on called The Strange Attractor. So he was applying chaos theory through a McLuhan filter.
So does that apply here? You'd say the telegraph is a strange attractor, and
yes,
and but humans are unconsciously working towards realizing it, even though they don't know what they're working towards.
Yeah, no one knew in the 1800s, 1700s, that they were extending our bodies.
How does that strange attractor posit itself?
You know what the strange attractor was? It was our body. And we didn't realize until the 20th century that we were extending parts of our body.
Mm-hmm.
So the body, as McLuhan says in this book, Laws of Media, is the hidden ground of all technologies.
Mm.
So by the 20th century, James Joyce McCombe could look back on the process and see that it was predetermined, that we were extending parts of ourselves, our limbs and external faculties, and eventually would extend our internal faculties.
And we couldn't help to do that because I would assume of the momentum of the development of language became a force which started pulling us along with it like a river.
Yeah, yeah. And so as I write in my essay, Up the Orphic Ante, written around the time this chart was made in 95, 96, Joyce realized that the whole cycle of invention, art, and science was predetermined. Not the timing of when we would do it.
Yeah.
I mean, a society could get bogged down for 300 years trying to get the telegraph, or for 1,000 years. But certainly once the printing press came in 1500, that kind of consolidated a way of thinking
right. Globally. Now,
so it created visual space as a frame, so then technologies could fit into that. Because people had invented odd little electrical devices 2,000 years ago, recordings of this. But nobody knew what to do with them. There's no context, so they would kill the inventor.
Mm.
So the point is, there's a pre.
Kill the inventor?
What?
Kill the inventor?
Yeah, they would do that.
Because he was a heretic, or just because...
Yeah, he created something that they saw would upset their system.
Mm.
They actually had an ecological sense, but it was a paranoid sense. But here's the thing. This predetermined aspect, which I spell out in my Up the Orphic Ante, and which Joyce is showing in the book Finnegan's Wake, is another way of interpreting the formula. Co-evolutionary anticipatory mimesis equals how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho in American politics. Another way of saying that the unfolding of technology equals an evolutionary predetermined process.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, let me interject here. another point of view, and this is the theosophy. This is Blavatsky. Now, she said that she believed that there was. She called it the rain cloud of unknowable things. That these media archetypes, these technologies, exist on some abstract plane, the causal plane, or some other world. They've already been invented in the future, and all time is simultaneous, and that these ideas, if we have a scientist or someone who's meditating on new invention, they're literally pulling the archetype off the shelf. They're pulling it down through the stages from subtle to causal to gross manifest.
Yeah, from the Akashic Records?
Right. It already exists, and they're just pulling it out of the Akashic Records. So that's the way that the mystics think about it.
That's right. She came up with this idea, Blavatsky, in the telegraph era, moving into the movies and telephone and automobiles. She came up with this in the 18, and she died in 1891, I think. So
she didn't simply come up with the idea. There was some guy that she referred to as the Tibetan.
Yeah, she learned it from.
She would meditate, and he would transmit ideas into her head from Tibet or where or the Shambhala or wherever he lived.
Right. She tuned into the store of knowledge in Asia.
Yeah.
The esoteric systems in Asia.
Yeah.
But
she didn't think of it as mediumship or channeling. She thought of it as, though, that, you know, messages were being telegraphed.
Yeah, and they used the term telegraph. There's a whole book called Spirits in the Air, I think it is, by an academic who goes through all the populist, mystical, theosophical, seance channeling movements in the 1850s into the early part of the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
And they all were talking about what they were doing with telegraph metaphors and with telephones. They were actually, according to my chart, responding to the effect of the telegraph and the telephone. They were translating the discarnate, in McLuhan terms, effect of the electric environment and putting it into the astral body, or occult references to life on another dimension, after death, before death.
Well, that's because they simply had a new metaphor.
They had a new technology, which was their metaphor.
Yeah, but, I mean, they were already having these mystical astral mediumship stuff. It had been going on for thousands of years. It's
but
just that everybody...
But they didn't talk about it as a telephone.
No, I know, but when... But
that's
every...
what they called it. They called it a telegraph.
I know, but, when Yogananda came to America, he tried to talk about the science of yoga. He wanted to fit it into a scientific... Because that's the only way he could get scientifically, rationally minded people to want to think about what... But he didn't think of it in those metaphors when he was growing up in India. He just used the new scientific...
Not the scientific ideas. He just looked at what the environment was, the technical environment. People were using telephones.
Yeah, so he thought, well, you know, I can't get these people who are all disconnected from their astral bodies and they don't believe in mediumship, so I'll talk about it in terms of, you know, telephone messages, something they can understand. Didn't necessarily change what he you know, whatever happens when somebody channels or whatever. They're just using a new metaphor to try to convince people that it's real.
Right, and what the mystical tradition, the Yogananda is his name?
Yeah.
What he missed was that you didn't need to teach people to astroproject, that they were doing it by telephone.
Well,
any traveling.
Yeah, we would disagree on that point.
Well, it's a semantic point, but
I don't think it's even a semantic point. I just simply disagree. The experience of astral traveling that I have at night when I drop off into the dream state is quite significantly different from picking up the telephone and projecting myself in technologically in the way that we're talking about.
Okay, now that is a core theme that we discussed and argued about all the way through the quotes of Thaddeus Communis, especially in the McLuhan section.
Mm-hmm.
And the Thompson section, right?
Yeah.
So that's the core argument, discussion, dialectic that's going on in my book. How much is the non-Western mystical knowledge applicable to the technical effect? And you're saying it's not at all similar.
Yeah, when you they can measure your brain waves. Your waking state is basically beta and alpha when you're relaxed, and then you drop into theta. When you drop into theta, you're sort of in the astral dream realm, and then you can drop into delta. That's got nothing to do with technology.
But remember when the scientists for General Electric studied McLuhan's theory in the late 60s, he realized it did affect the brain waves. Krugman, his name was, K-R-U-G-M-A-N. Krugman produced this paper saying that he set out to disprove McLuhan, but he found out that he measured the brainwaves and the alpha and the beta were the results of different media.
Yeah.
Okay, so the brainwaves were affected. And if you're talking about brainwaves, that's a Western, what I call chemical body form of knowledge. The mystics in other cultures didn't have the idea of brainwaves.
No, but they were shifting their brain waves. They just didn't have a way to measure it.
Or to image it, because they didn't have the chemical knowledge of the 19th century.
Yeah.
Or the microscopic instrumental knowledge.
Right.
But then when they became aware of it, they claimed that that's what they were talking about, and that they could do it without technology.
Right.
But they never understood that speech was a technology.
Right.
So this issue of whether one is doing something different when you're dreaming, remember, Finnegan's Wake is about a dream, ostensibly, and dreaming awake. So it's embedded right there in the book, Finnegan's Wake. And he had a lot of references to Blavatsky in Finnegan's Wake.
Well, the dreaming awake didn't refer to the phone. It referred more to the television, I think.
No, referred to all of media. A book was a form of dreaming awake.
Oh.
The relationship between different media environments is one of the hidden patterns of Joyce's work.
Because I thought McLuhan said going into the movie theater was like dreaming, like sleep dreaming, and watching TV was like lucid dreaming.
No, he said that movies were a dream and television was a fantasy. Because when you watch a movie, you're matching an image that's projected at you. It's light off the wall. It's light off. Whereas, or actually he called it light on, bouncing off a book page or the movie screen wall. But television was light through. Therefore, your brain had to make the image. It was more of a participatory making activity of the cognitive faculty of the TV watcher, which tended more towards fantasy because there wasn't an image you were matching which is what dreams do. You were making up a totally subjective image.
Well, it's more participatory, and that's how they distinct. That's how dream researchers such as LaBarge distinguish between sleep dreaming and lucid dreaming. In lucid dreaming, you're now you become the participant in the dream. In other words, you're causing, you're directing. You've become the director, and you're directing the dream.
Right, and that may be a hyper romanticization of this: the fact that the making faculty is engaged in your dreaming, and that's what happens when you do TV.
Yeah,
you're making. Now, the other point is that you subjectively can have a dream, or watch movies privately, or watch TV. But when the whole population is watching movies or watching TV, McLuhan suggested that the effect of watching TV contains all the previous technologies that led to the invention of television, and that is like lucid dreaming because you're seeing what happened in the various phases as spelled out on this chart, the hidden and bottom-up unknown effects, the unknown teleological final causes, finally arrives at television. So therefore, the collectivity that's watching television, they can become conscious of all the previous stages that led to television, and that's a kind of lucid dreaming.
You're watching the dream from outside the dream.
No, that's a visual. That's what a literate person thinks. You are the screen, McLuhan said.
Mm-hmm.
But collectively, if you learn about what McLuhan's saying or what Joyce is saying, you realize that the population has become and arrived at a condition of dreaming awake because all the technologies before television were just aspects of our senses, fragments, but it all imploded into a coherent image which you can watch live. And so, yes, you're dreaming awake, but it's a collective dreaming awake. That's different from an individual dreaming awake.
Well, you could argue the reverse, that all of your senses have become completely and finally numbed and killed off, and you've just become somatic.
Or non-somatic.
Well, you've just become...
a nerve ending.
Yeah, you become entranced, totally enchanted, totally entranced.
Right, and the lucidity dreaming part of it is that you might notice that previous environments had put people in trances. And you might think, oh, the medium is the message. But you may not realize that the trance caused by television is a condition that makes you realize about the effects of previous environments. But you don't notice that television is allowing you to do that, or what television does to you in realizing that.
Yeah.
It's another meta.
Well, now because of the computer and the internet, we've shifted. Once you shift to that, I think it's easier to see the effects that the TV is having, because you're looking at the effects of the TV from a different stance or position or point of view outside of the effect of the TV.
Yeah, you're in a next level of lucid dreaming. And are you aware of what the computer's doing to you as it makes you aware of what the TV did?
Well, not unless there's a next stage beyond that, which I think your chart gets into, but most people probably aren't aware.
Yeah, my chart is trying to show what we've just been discussing the last 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's trying to show the stages of wakefulness.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Yeah.
And so the human part under ISSI...
Well, you know... Wakefulness.
The causes of what the fights were about.
Right.
And so under ISSI, you have the anthropomorphic or the human presidential names. There is the effect represented by each president and the historical image.
Yeah, but
the historical
each
image relates to the section of the chart they're in.
Each president likes to evoke the great things that previous presidents did that we all admire, such as Abraham Lincoln or George Washington, so we can't necessarily say that those men were any less awake.
They were using the past to justify what they did. They may not have been aware of the effects that they were implementing or the environments they were living in, and that is what's represented on the far right column. Under HCE, you got lockdown centralization. Washington did not know that the complex of technologies of his time would lead to a favoring of the federation of states more than states' rights. That's locking down, completing centralization. The later presidents, like Roosevelt and Kennedy, did not know that they were locking down a world government or a decentralization of the former centralization.
Yeah, they must have had some intuition about where they were going. You can't navigate the ocean unless you have some sense of what direction you're heading.
That's under HCE. That's the intelligence agency. It's pretty smart people who are studying the effects as much as they can, and they represent a knowledge that's relatively secret, or they keep it secret within, quote, national security. And they're the ones that the president listens to.
Yeah, they inform the president.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So, let's wrap this up with anything else you want to say right now. It's break time, and then we'll get back. We'll dive back in part
well,
B.
I'm glad that you got an idea more clearly about what HCE represents.
Oh yeah, this
yeah.
is a great discussion for me. Anyway, I'm getting a better able to look at this chart.
Okay, let's take a break, and then we'll do side B.
Sounds good.
Okay, thanks. Bye.